England, There, England by A.G. MacDonald. Adapted in 6 parts by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. Episode 1.
The events I'm going to describe had their origin in a conversation between two artillery officers on the Western Front in October 1917. And although their words were spoken on the slopes of the Passchendaele Ridge, needn't be afraid that this is a war story. After this episode, there will be, to borrow the name of an ardent society of left-wing pacifists, no more war. The conversation between the artillery officers took place in one of those rectangular, reinforced concrete frog-like boxes with which the German military engineers had sprinkled Flanders, so their effete and pampered infantry wouldn't have to sleep in 6 inches of water under a sheet of corrugated iron. It was soon decided that frontline British troops should be housed in pillboxes in order to stave off influenza, frostbite and trench feet, all of which were bad for morale, and worse still, offered excuses for malingering. On the slopes of the Passchendaele Ridge, about 200 yards east of the Steenbeek River, and when I say east, I mean on the German side, and when I say river, I mean a ditch about 9 feet wide, there stood a pillbox so large and with walls so thick that it served as HQ for 2 adjoining battalions, the 17th Rutland Fusiliers and the 24th Melton Mowbray Light Infantry. The aforementioned artillery officers were Lieutenant Evan Davies, attached to the Rutlands, and Lieutenant Donald Cameron, attached to the Melton Mowbrays, each for a period of 4 days. They began by discussing the usual topic.
Marmalade.
What, again?
That's 3 days in the trot. On a whiff of jam in the rations.
You should worry. 3 days. In the Sutherlands, I went jamless for 93 days. This makes 96 for me.
Oh, beat you hands down, boy. Add these 3 to my score with East Flint, and I'm in the lead by 22 days. Novice.
I think it'll be over by Christmas.
The marmalade, I bloody hope so.
Every autumn this happens. People get their hopes up the minute the first leaf falls. Maybe, just maybe, we'll be home before the year's out.
It's been so long now, I've almost forgotten where home is.
Will somewhere, I imagine.
Well, not lately. Before I joined up, I was 5 years in London. I dare say that's where all the jam is.
I've only ever been there for the odd day or two's leave.
Funny thing is, I bet I'm none the wiser about the English than you are.
I've really only seen them as soldiers.
And what do you think?
Strange mixture. The last time I was liaison to an English battalion, the colonel wore an eyeglass and spent all day sat in a dugout reading the Tatler. We were 6 days in the line and he had the wind up throughout. Well, except once. The time he walked up to a Bosch machine gun emplacement armed with a walking stick.
My God, what happened?
58 Bosch came out and surrendered. Do you suppose he was mad?
That's hard to say, eh? We had an English subaltern once who used to put out fires in ammunition dumps.
He what? Whatever for?
He said shells cost a fiver each, and it was our duty to save government money.
Where's he buried?
That little cemetery at the back of Lamerting.
I know.
Aye.
Why? Why does the English always laugh when Aberdeen is mentioned?
Ah, search me. Why does he have a Welsh Prime Minister and a Scotch command...
Not Scotch. Scots or Scottish.
Oh, sorry. A Scots or Scottish Commander-in-Chief. And come to that, a Scots or Scottish First Sea Lord of the Admiralty. He seems to find that hysterical.
He does.
Here's another thing, Cameron. You see, the Englishman prides himself on having always beaten the French except at Hastings, right?
Right.
So, how come the French army's doing so much better in this war than the English?
The French are hotter in the paperwork.
They must be. Because your English soldier, the fellow who actually fights, is amazingly good.
Mm. Yes, but then why does the Englishman
oh,
always...
Oh, pity's sake, it's going to drive us mad. Here. Have a drop of Scotch. Oh, I beg your pardon. Have a drop of Scots or Scottish.
Lovely.
Cheers. Oh. No, the more I see of the Englishman, the more bewildered I become. He's the kindliest soul in the world, but if he sees something beautiful flying in the air or running on the ground, he gets a gun and kills it. If an earthquake devastates North Borneo, he dashes off to the Mansion House, blocking up the traffic for miles around, trying to hand over money for disaster relief. But do you think he'll lift a finger to abolish his own slums? Mm. If you assault him and bash his teeth down his throat, well, that's just playfulness. You had 14 days in jug. But if you do it and nick his watch at the same time, that's robbery with violence. You get 18 strokes with the cat in about 3 years in Dartmoor. And you can do what you like to a stag or a fox, that's sport. But say you approve of bullfights, and you're lucky to escape with your life. I reckon all these oddities and incongruities arise from the fact that underneath it all, he's a poet. Mind you, he'd be lurid with rage if you told him. I tell you, if I can extract myself from this bloody Armageddon, I'm going to put my theory to the test.
What are you going to do? Write a book?
No, I don't write books. I publish them.
Really?
Oh, yes, yes. I've got an office near Covent Garden. Well, I did have. I hope it'll be there when I get back.
You wouldn't be looking for a writer.
Always am, old boy. It's part of the job. Look, if you want to work in London, come and see me and we will talk it over. You'll find me in the phone book, Davies and Thorwell and Glendower, Henrietta Street.
Seriously?
Oh, you bet your life. Now, write it down before you forget it. Here, put it in your gun registration book.
The German artillery was tuning up for its evening performance, and an occasional thud shook the pillbox. But it was not the shells that worried the two gunners. The real danger was the infantry might get agitated and ask for an SOS to be sent to the protecting artillery. The Rutland's adjutant came elbowing his way towards them through the crowd.
SOS, chaps! It might be an attack!
Oh, hell! Now we're off. £5 for a bun, my wire is down.
All the wires will be down. Got your gas mask?
Yes. Have you got any rockets? Mine were blown into a shell hole on the way up.
Four. Two red, two green.
God almighty! If they don't see the rockets, Cameron, one of us will have to run for it. No one in the world could mend a wire in all that.
Well, let's hope the damn things work.
We'll soon find out. Beautiful! I'm seeing green stars!
Let's try the red one! Oh no, it's not going to burst!
Try the other red one!
The two gunners crouched down behind the broken parapet and waited. If the rockets weren't seen by the artillery, one of them would have to try crossing the open mile and a half to the nearest battery with a 500-to-1 chance of getting through. And if he failed, the other would have to try.
It looks like a wash-up. I've got a fan here somewhere. We better toss for who goes first.
Right.
What do you call?
Heads.
Well, thank God. They've seen them. Come on.
And with a huge grin on his face, Davies sprang back into the shelter of the pillbox. Cameron paused to retrieve the Frank from the mud, and a 5.9 high-explosive shell pitched beside him. He woke up a fortnight later, concussed and shell-shocked in the Duchess of Westminster's hospital, Le Touquet. One of the routes by which shell-shocked officers progressed from the base hospitals back to health was via a temporary row of huts in Palace Green, two enchanting private houses on the top of Camden Hill, and finally a monster hydropathic in Scotland. So it was not until 1920 that he packed his valise for the last time, saluted a major for the last time, and departed in a first-class carriage for the last time for many years to Aberdeen, and from there by slow train to the country district of Buchan. His father, Ewan Cameron, owned a farm there called the Means of Balspindie, and Ewan was known throughout the region as the best singer, the best violinist, the champion whiskey drinker, the quickest-tempered, kindest-hearted, handsomest old man. and the worst farmer. And when Donald arrived home with his £85 per annum, less tax, courtesy of the Minister of Pensions, the old man was surprised.
This is no place for a young man.
Thanks for the welcome, Father.
Oh, there you go with your tongue. I didn't say I'm not glad to see you. I am, for my sake, but not for yours. Balspindy is for old men.
So what's for young men?
The world.
Oh, I've seen quite enough of the world for the time being.
Oh, and I thought you might be thinking that. It's the child's instinct. You've been hurt, so you run home to your mother. Well, she's dead, and Balspindy has to do in her place. Mm. Well, you're welcome, and you can stay till you're well again. When you are, you'll leave me. Not because I tell you to, but because you'll want to. Meanwhile, there's plenty to do here. For a start, you can fetch another bottle.
Ewan was right. There was plenty to do, and Donald did it. He got up early and went to bed early. He worked in the fields and in time ploughed a furrow that was quite creditable.
I might have ploughed that one myself.
Really?
Aye, if I'd been blindfolded and short of one arm.
Thanks.
And with a team of horses rocking about like steeplechasers.
For several years, father and son continued this queer, incongruous partnership until the senior partner dissolved it by dying. Ewan Cameron made as little fuss about dying as he had about living. He went to bed around 6 one evening in late summer and told the dairymaid to go out into the fields for Donald. When the young man came in, he found his father waking from a doze and smiling a smile that Franz Hals might have painted.
Oh, I'm far off, boy.
No.
Oh, what's with you? You sound worse than me.
I ran all the way over stubble.
Go to the Gordon Barracks in Aberdeen tomorrow and bring a piper who can play a Cameron Lament.
Father?
And you get away from Buchan. It's not our country. Oh, don't be afraid. I'm not going to start babbling of green fields.
Father? Father?
So, Mr. Cameron, it appears that as a result of your father's death, you're just over £7,000 better off. It's an ill wind.
Oh. Well, thanks.
However, there is one stipulation. Mr. Cameron Sr. stated in his will that the money is yours on condition that you spend no more than 1 month per annum north of the Tweed until you reach the age of 50.
Really?
Gets better and better, doesn't it? I'm sure a young shaver like yourself can't wait to get off to the high life, eh?
Quite.
Anyway, don't let me detain you. You'll be wanting to pack your bags.
Donald Cameron had no professional qualifications, save the ability to drive a moderately crooked furrow and direct the fire of a battery of 18-pounder guns. So he resolved to try his fortune as a journalist. There seemed to be no other profession which required neither ability nor training. He was fortified in this resolution by some letters of introduction from a lecturer in Italian and the librarian at Aberdeen University, all of them addressed to literary men. But it was these very letters that led to a small difficulty at 7:30 a.m. on the day the Aberdeen Express drew up at King's Cross and decanted a tousled and sleepy Donald from his third-class corner. For the lecturer in Italian had warmly recommended Chelsea as the only possible region in which a literary man could reside, whereas the librarian had repeatedly affirmed that no one who was anyone lived further from the British Museum than the average athlete at the Boyne Games could throw a stone. But Chelsea and Bloomsbury were all one to Donald, both as residential districts and as movements in art. So it was the spin of the coin on the station platform that directed him towards Chelsea. By tea time, he was installed in a bed sitting room on the second floor of a house just off the King's Road. The landlady was an elderly dame with a roving eye who looked as if she'd had her fling 40 years before. Her daughter also had a roving eye and looked as if she was ready to have a fling at any moment.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
It's Donald, isn't it?
Oh, yes, I suppose it is.
I'm Gladys. The W is silent.
Is it?
Oh, you're Scotch.
No, actually, I'm Scots.
Thought so. We've got something in common.
But you appear to be Welsh.
That's right. We're fellow Celts, you silly boy.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I do like a nice chat with an eligible young man.
Do you?
Such a rarity since my poor dear fiancé, he was a naval commander, you know, killed at Jutland.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Very fond of port, he was.
He didn't like sailing.
Port wine, dear.
Oh, I see. Well, yes, given the choice, I think I'd prefer port wine to Jutland.
Oh, so gifted with words. I can see I shall have to be careful or you'll be putting me into one of your books.
Donald's first letter of introduction was to the literary editor of a well-known weekly paper which had leanings towards a mild form of intellectual socialism. Mind you, no one would have been more alarmed than the said literary editor if a sudden swing of the political pendulum had brought about the very changes his paper so eloquently advocated. For although he despised money, he was heartily fond of much that it could buy. He was a brilliant critic, a vile editor, and a superb luncher-out. His name was...
Mr. Charles Ossery, please.
You have an appointment?
No, but I do have this letter of introduction.
It's quite impossible to see Mr. Ossery without an appointment.
Then could I make an appointment?
I have full authority to make appointments on Mr. Ossery's behalf.
Oh, good. Well, perhaps later this afternoon...
Impossible.
Then maybe tomorrow morning.
Out of the question. But if you care to call back at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon, it's just possible that Mr. Ossery may be back from his lunch.
Surely you mean from his tea.
From his lunch.
On the Tuesday afternoon, Donald presented himself nervously at the Dragonlet's den and waited for an hour till the butler of a dowager marchioness telephoned to say Mr. Ossery would not be returning to work that day. On the Wednesday afternoon, it was the secretary to the wife of a cabinet minister who rang, and on the Thursday, a countess whose quarterings were unimpeachable, but whose income did not stretch to a telephonic intermediary. On Friday, Mr. Ossery went away for his usual weekend, returning on Tuesday just in time not to go to the office. And it was only by chance that a hasty visit on the Wednesday afternoon to correct the proofs of a wise and witty article about Molière happened to coincide with one of Donald's vigils.
You're a persistent man, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you, I suppose.
Oh, it's a compliment, right enough. Persistence pays in this business, and you're...
Mr. Ossery, have you corrected that proof yet?
Not yet, Miss Garrison. As you can see, I'm still talking to Mr. Cameron.
Well, really?
Forgive me. No, as I say, your letter of introduction fills me with high hopes. I'm sure I can offer you something.
Really?
How would you like to...
Mr. Ossery, you haven't forgotten you're taking tea with Mr. George Bernard Shaw.
All in due course, Miss Garrison. Mr. Shaw may look like old Father Time, but I'm assured he does wait for some men.
What?
Now, where was I?
You were about to offer me...
Ah, yes. How would you like to compile a list of new novels for the autumn edition of our book supplement? I'll pay you 3 guineas.
Ah. Yes. Yes, love to.
And, do you think there might be other opportunities after that?
Well, I wouldn't like to promise, Mr. Cameron. You see, the literary world is grotesquely overcrowded, and it's only possible for men of exceptional talent to enter it. And then only if they've already been in it for some years.
I'm sorry?
It stands to reason. Unless they'd been in it for years, how could they show their exceptional talent?
It says a great deal for Mr. Osser's charm that he made this sound quite reasonable, but it wasn't till Donald returned to his lodgings and pondered the matter that he decided to give up the Irishman as a potential patron and to try the second letter of introduction. This was addressed to Mr. Alexander Ogilvy, LLD of St. Andrews University, editor of the Illustrated Planet. Mr. Ogilvy's business habits were different, apparently, from those of Mr. Ossery, for he made an appointment with Donald for 8:30 a.m. The sudden jarring of the electric bell at 8:31 a.m. came like the whistles of the platoon commander at 0 hour, and his eyes were all blurred when he shambled through a glass door into the presence of a very small man with an enormous head. Donald Twitter, with nervous palpitations, wondered what the little man's first words, if anything, would be. As it was, they were unintelligible.
Eracht mamor or fasifern.
Donald had started and swept a large glass ink bottle to the floor, where it shivered into 10,000 splinters and flung its blue-black contents into every corner of the room.
I'm so sorry. I'll mop it up with my handkerchief.
Stay put. We have office boys for that.
Of course.
I was asking you to what branch of the Clan Cameron you belonged.
I don't know exactly.
It's a poor Highlander who doesn't know his own chieftain. Now, my good friend Mr. Gregg of the College Library tells me you want to enter upon a literary career.
Well,
he says you have all the makings.
Oh.
Well, maybe you have and maybe you haven't. But there are two ways to find out. Either go home and write something good. So if it's good, it'll be published. Or start in as a journalist.
That was my idea.
Good. Now, I've been asked to find a man, an apprentice for a paper. That's how we all started. Would you like the job?
Like it? I would love it.
Good. It's on the Glossop Evening Mail.
On the what?
Glossop Evening Mail. Glossop. Town in Derbyshire.
But...
Eh?
What?
Hmm?
I thought you meant a job in London.
Young man, London is halfway up the ladder. You must start on the lowest rung. Your niche is Glossop.
The third and last of Donald's letters of introduction was to a Mr. William Hodge, editor of the London Weekly.
Mr. Cameron, come and sit down. How's my good friend, Mr. Gregg?
He sent you a letter. I have it here, sir.
Oh, don't bother about that. Letters of introduction are usually lies. The real question at the moment is whether you play cricket.
Cricket?
I'm raising a side to play a village in Kent, Saturday week.
Well, I haven't played for ages.
Oh, doesn't matter, two straws. Do you battle bowl?
Not really either.
Splendid. Now, what about a drink?
The Black Cat public house was already crowded, although it was not yet 12 o'clock. Inevitably, Mr. Hodge encountered some colleagues, and before long, they were deep in an argument about the comparative merits of two rugby wing forwards, neither of whose names was familiar to Donald. So, pint mug in hand, he edged his way to the end of the line, where a pleasant voice at his elbow observed,
"Didn't we share a pillbox at Passion Day?"
"Davies! Daredevil!
That's right, aye. Cheers! Ah, yes, clever of you to remember.
Not bad, though I say so myself. I got concussed that last day. Since then, my memory's been none too reliable.
Then I'll bet you don't recall my suggestion.
Give me a clue.
Well, I am, thank God, once again a publisher. And when we were both hapless subalterns, I suggested you might try a book about England and seen through the eyes of a Scotsman. Would you like to have a shot at it? We could fix up food and meet people, you know, the typically English.
I'd love to have a shot at it.
Well, splendid. When can you start, boy?
At once, if you like.
I do, because I've got a small dinner party tonight. Just the sort of people who might be useful. Will you come? 8:15.
I should like to.
Black tie, 74B Mount.
I'll be there.
Oh, all right, listen.
By the way, since I saw you last, I've found out a couple of things about the Englishman, things you must never, ever rag him about. One is the team spirit in cricket. You must never suggest there are any individuals in the game.
Oh, I must remember that on Saturday week. I'm playing for Mr. Hodge over there. And what's the other thing you mustn't rag them about?
Lord Nelson.
There were four other guests at Davy's dinner party, and each of them took a kindly interest in the diffident stranger. Most significantly, Lady Ormerod, MP, invited him to spend the following weekend at her house in Surrey. Next time, we'll find out why she greeted him with the words,
"The Duke of Devonshire telephoned for you. You are on no account to ring him, but you must go to Chatsworth for luncheon on Monday."
When Donald had never even met the man, we also discover why an alluring vamp named Esmeralda purred at him.
Oh, you're a film magnate. I adore film magnates.
When the poor boy hadn't even caught Birth of a Nation at the Aberdeen Bioscope. And we'll meet a man whose first words to Donald were,
"Scum! Filthy, lousy, herring-gutted, spavin-bellied scum!"
Spavin?
Join us then.
Part one of England There, England by A.G. MacDonald was adapted by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips, with Sam Graham as Donald Cameron, Sean Prendergast as Davies, Peter Kelly as Ewan Cameron, Katie Odie as Gladys, Christopher Benjamin as Mr. Ossery, and Denise Coffey as Miss Garrison. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper, Kevin Oliver, and Vicky Carter. The director was Neil Cargill. England There, England is a Splice of Life production for BBC Radio 2.